Ali said. We don't have to turn members of the Duarte cartel against one another since it's already happening. But how do we take advantage of that reality?
Wait, Stu said excitedly. Here's an idea. In the world of gangs and drug cartels, there's nothing lower than a snitch. That's why the Duartes went after that guy in Las Cruces, because he was an informant. What would happen if we convinced El Pescado that Graciela was about to turn state's evidence? There's no one on the planet who could do more damage to his organization than she could.
But how do we get him to believe she's turned on him?
Easy, Stu said, by bringing her to us.
And how do you propose to do that?
By using Frigg and me as bait.
That sounds dangerous, Allie said.
Not as dangerous as leaving them on the loose, Stu replied.
Does this mean you were actually paying attention back when I was telling you about the bad guy's playbook? Cammy asked.
Yes, I was, Stu said. The stalking phase is over. It's time to bring Graciela Miramar within striking distance.
That statement was greeted with nods of agreement all around the table. With the decision made, the mood in the room brightened, shifting from one of grim hopelessness to a shared sense of purpose. So, where do we start? Allie asked.
First up, Stu needs to contact Graciela and give her those banking codes, B said. We need to make certain that no matter what happens next, he has access to those funds.
But I thought Stu said the office is closed today.
It is, he replied. But let me take a look at that letter.
Removing it from his pocket, he studied the stationery.
Her cell phone is listed and so is her email. We know she's been logging into her work accounts all night long. I'll send her a message and ask her to give me a call.
There wasn't a person in the room who wasn't astonished by that statement. In the past, for the old Stu, the prospect of having to speak to a stranger on the phone or in person would have been anathema, leaving him drenched in sweat and worry. But this was the new Stuart Ramey, Stuart 2.0.
But before I send that message, there's something we need to do first.
What?
We're going to go into the lab, put on a show, and hope to hell someone is listening. By the time we finish, Graciela won't just want Frigg. She'll have to have her.
I want to fix it so that as far as Graciela is concerned, gaining control of Frigg will be a matter of life and death. Chapter 50 Graciela had stayed up late, following the news feeds out of Sinaloa. She had gone to bed only when a fire brigade official announced that the sole fatality of the accidental fire at the Duarte family compound had been identified as Felix Duarte's son Pablo. Graciela knew for sure that the fire was anything but accidental. She supposed the cops knew that too, but they were bound not to find otherwise. After all, no police officer in the country had either balls enough or was stupid enough to suggest that Felix, the cartel king of Sinaloa, might have taken out his own son. Since Recursos was closed for the day, Graciela was still in bed and sleeping soundly when Isabel's call awakened her.
"Did you hear?" Isabel asked.
"Hear what?"
"It's all over the news. They caught the kid who killed Arturo. After the cops arrested him, he led them to the body. He was dumped in the Parque Nacional just off Highway 4.
The fact that the killer had been arrested was not welcome news to Graciela, but she kept her wits about her and didn't stumble.
"Really?" she managed. "That sounds like good news."
"It is good news," Isabel agreed. "I talked to Natalia. Even though the body has been found, we're still holding the vigil. Their house is a long way out of town, and I know you don't have a car. Would you like a ride?"
Naturally, Isabel assumed Graciela would want to attend. Although going to Arturo's vigil was the last thing Graciela wanted to do, she knew that her being there would arouse less suspicion than her not going.
"Sure," she said. "What time?"
"It starts at 6, and I want to be there early to help set up, so I should probably pick you up around 5.
"All right," Graciela said. "See you then."
For some time after the call ended, she stayed in bed. She had known the hit on Arturo would be passed off to some underling. The problem was, if the shooter had been caught and was cooperating with the police, he might have been offered some kind of plea deal. That was bad news. In that kind of situation, heads would roll, and there was no telling how far up the chain of command the damage would go. Could the trail possibly lead back to her? Maybe. And if that happened, she was far less worried about the cops than she was about her father. She could see now that in seizing and using her newfound power, she had also allowed emotion to get in the way of good sense. She didn't fault herself for taking out Ron Webster. The man had been incompetent. He had failed to do a job properly and then lied about it. Letting something like that go unpunished would have been a sign of weakness on her part. And the Webster hit had offered the perfect setup for taking out Pablo. With him gone, she needed some time to consolidate her position, to move assets around, and make some adjustments before El Pescado and Manny came to her looking for an accounting. But now, because of the hit on Arturo, a hit done strictly out of spite, time might be a problem. With that worrisome thought in mind, Graciela crawled out of bed and headed for the kitchen to make coffee, grabbing her computer along the way. Savoring the reality of living alone, she stood by the kitchen counter and logged into her work email account. As soon as she did so, there it was, the message she'd been waiting for. s.ramey@highnoon.com.
Dear Ms. Miramar, thank you for contacting me. Please accept my apologies for not replying immediately. It took some time for me to locate the information you required. Now that I have it, I have concerns about sending this kind of private information over the unsecured internet. I would prefer to speak to you directly. The number for my cell phone is listed below. Please contact me at your earliest convenience. Sincerely, Stuart Ramey.
Graciela had been so caught up in what was going on in Sinaloa that she hadn't checked in on the surveillance feeds to see what was happening in Arizona. Rather than reply immediately, she moved over to her surveillance storage site, where she was relieved to find several recorded files awaiting her. At 10 p.m. on Sunday night, there was a recorded file featuring a lot of back and forthing between a man and a woman. Graciela couldn't identify exactly who the two people were, but they had come into the office in order to put together an emergency communication of some kind, one letting clients know that there had been an intrusion at High Noon's corporate headquarters with no accompanying data breach. After that, there were blips and pieces of recording that captured sounds rather than conversation, including a good deal of keyboarding, which most likely meant that they were settled in at separate computer terminals working away. Had Ron Webster done the job right, Graciela would have had a video feed to show her exactly what was going on. Much later, though, there was another spate of conversation. This one was harder to make out, as though the discussion was going on at a fair distance from the location of the listening device. But Graciela was pretty sure she heard the word Frigg mentioned more than once. Then a new file appeared. Clicking on it, Graciela heard the sound of two raised male voices. After listening in for a moment or two, she realized the first voice had to belong to High Noon's owner, B. Simpson, while the second voice must be Stuart Ramey's.
"Are you friggin' kidding me? That damned AI has keylogger capability?"
"Look, our scans found it. I disabled the Trojan before it had a chance to do any damage."
"You'd better hope to high heaven that you disabled it in time.
How the hell did she get it past the firewall in the first place?
I replied to a routine email. Frigg must have hidden the Trojan in the reply field. Our scans found it within 5 minutes.
I don't care if they found it in 5 seconds. The fact that she got in at all is a serious breach. I want you to get rid of that damned AI. And I want you to get rid of it now, understand? Either Frigg goes or you go. Do I make myself clear?
Graciela had been standing by the kitchen counter, sipping coffee as she listened to the files. Now her legs went wobbly underneath her. Taking the computer with her, she staggered over to the dining room table and dropped onto a chair. A keylogger. What if Odin had unleashed a keylogger on her? And if the Trojan had been concealed in the reply field of her email accounts? This was a huge problem, and the potential for damage was unimaginable. She had corresponded with Odin, and probably Frigg too, countless times from both her computers, the one at work and the one at home. A keylogger would have captured everything, all her transactions, all her searches, everything. The Trojan would have recorded the fact that she had erased her browsing history, but a record of the searches themselves would still be available. And what about the blockchain technology? Did that mean that Frigg had been able to use Odin's Bitcoin mining operation to trace all of Graciela's transactions, even the ones conducted on the dark web? She had always assumed that transactions on her home computer were entirely private. But how many times had she told Arturo that the cybersecurity situation at Recursos Empresariales Internacionales was lacking? That was one of the reasons she'd done so many of her transactions, especially her family's transactions, from home. But had Frigg captured those too? And did Stuart Ramey have any idea what he had? A new recording appeared in the surveillance feed. Graciela's hand trembled as she pushed the play arrow. Now a man and a woman were speaking in somewhat more subdued tones.
I don't care if he is the boss. He's got no right to talk to me that way.
He's got a point. He has a business to run, and people are counting on him and on us to keep their information safe. If we've been infected with a keylogger...
Like I told him, I caught it within 5 minutes.
Get rid of Frigg, Stu. Having her around isn't worth it.
It is worth it. Do you have any idea how much Frigg would bring on the open market?
Yes, probably $4 million for starters. So why don't you sell it and turn the AI into someone else's problem?
Why don't I keep it and see where it goes? It's already got an operating Bitcoin mining program running. Why don't I keep that and tell B. Simpson to take this job and shove it? I'm going for a walk, and I don't know when or if I'm coming back.
The recording ended, and Graciela sat where she was, as if carved from stone, trying to remember exactly how the AI functioned. She remembered Owen saying something to the effect that Frigg didn't have a standard directory, that you couldn't just look at a listing of files and know what was there. So perhaps Stuart didn't know the full extent of what he had. Perhaps there was some way to stave off this disaster, because once El Pescado discovered the extent of the breach, Graciela was dead meat, every bit as dead as Pablo. The first thing she needed to do was talk to Stuart Ramey. But she gave herself a few minutes to regain control. By the time she spoke to him, she had to be in top form. Chapter 51. Stu had left the computer lab, but not the building. Instead, he sat in the break room, watching his phone and waiting for it to ring. He had talked a good game earlier, but now as the minutes ticked by at glacial speed, he started to lose it. Would this wild hair of a plan work? And if not, was there anything else he could do to bring down Felix Duarte? They needed to have something on him that hadn't come to them by way of Frigg, some other crime for which he could be held responsible outside the realm of Sinaloa, where he no doubt had plenty of cops on the payroll. But then Stuart remembered. What about those 6 unsolved homicides from long ago? That's when he switched on the Bluetooth and grabbed his iPad.
Frigg.
I'm here, Stuart. How can I help? I want you to send me the names of the 6 airmen involved in the attacks on Christine Miramar in 1989. I want dates and places of birth, along with dates and places of death.
Of course. Where would you like me to send the information?
To the iPhone I'm using.
Will there be anything else?
The information you put in the report about the attack on her, that all came from common sources on the internet, correct?
Yes.
Good. When the information arrived, Stu used a pen to copy it onto a piece of paper and then sent Cammy a text asking her to come to the break room. When she did, he handed the list to her.
What's this?
These are the names of all the guys involved in the attack on Graciela's mother.
The dead guys?
Right. I want you to do a detailed search. Start with the attack, collect all the information on the court-martials, and then track down everything else you can find on these guys, including the circumstances surrounding their deaths.
Why? Cammy asked. Didn't Frigg already do this? Isn't this an unnecessary duplication of effort?
It's a necessary duplication of effort, Stu told her. I want you to make all of your searches trackable. And don't erase your browsing history when you finish. I want to be able to demonstrate that anything you find came from readily available sources.
Nothing we could have gotten from Frigg?
Exactly.
Has anyone ever told you that you're completely nuts? Cammy asked.
You more than anybody.
As Cammy left the break room shaking her head and clutching the paper, Stu's phone began to ring. She turned around. Do you want me to stay?
No, just go, he said. I need to do this on my own. Please shut the door.
He waited for it to close before he answered, then switched the phone to record.
As long as they seem to be doing illegal wiretaps right and left, why not add another one to the mix? Hello?
Mr. Ramey?
It was difficult for him to talk, but he managed, even though the underarms of his shirt were already damp.
Yes. It's Graciela Miramar. I'm so glad to make your acquaintance.
Same here.
Do you have the banking codes?
I hope you'll forgive my reluctance to send them over the internet.
Absolutely, Graciela said. When it comes to things like that, it's far better to be safe than sorry. I know the codes are complex and our connection isn't the best, but read them to me and I'll repeat them back to you.
It was a cumbersome process. By the time it was finished, Stu's whole shirt was soaked.
All right, she said at last. Let me key these in. Then you'll be good to go.
I'll be able to access the funds on my own then?
Yes, all of them. You can do that directly or you can go through me. I'm here to help with whatever you need.
And the Bitcoin mining operation? Stu asked.
I'm not sure how that happened, but it's already in your name.
Stu knew how it happened. Frigg. And he was pretty sure Graciela knew that was the answer as well. He almost sat on his hands to keep from saying anything about Frigg aloud. Stu knew enough about negotiations to understand that the first party who mentioned the existence of the AI would be the big loser. And he wasn't wrong. Luckily, Graciela didn't seem to share that knowledge.
When Owen Hansen was still alive, she began, we discussed the possibility of forming a partnership and creating a business of our own, offering the same kinds of services that are offered by my current employer, Recursos Empresariales Internacionales. The plan was for me to bring my financial experience, contacts, and expertise to the endeavor, and Owen would bring his AI.
Frigg, you mean?
Stuart asked as a drop of sweat ran down his forehead and dribbled into his eye.
So you know about Frigg?
How do you think I got the banking codes? Without her, I would have been out of luck.
I had her up and running, he said, but I had to shut her back down. She attempted to insert some unauthorized software into our system. As far as I'm concerned, she's not to be trusted.
Would you like to sell her? Graciela asked.
Sell her? I just told you I don't think she's trustworthy. Why would anyone want her?
Mr. Raimi, I have a client, a man of unlimited means, who would like nothing more than to have an AI of his own. What would it take to set up an operation like that?
If I were willing to sell her?
Yes.
There'd be the initial purchase price.
How much?
4 million, maybe? He asked.
That's doable, Graciela replied. What else?
You'd need to have a minimum of 800 GPUs. Those are computer blades, along with enough electrical capacity to operate them. You'd also need a facility with serious air conditioning capability. The GPUs run hot, and once they get overheated, they're toast.
What else?
AIs are complicated. You need a software engineer to do the installation and then ride herd on it.
Are you available, Mr. Raimi? She asked.
Me? Stewart echoed.
How much would my client need to pay you to lure you away from High Noon Enterprises?
You're offering me a job, just like that? You don't even know me.
I know that you were smart enough to reboot Frigg long enough to get the banking codes. That alone is enough to tell me that you're no dummy. And you're obviously overseeing the Bitcoin mining operation. So yes, I think your computer skills are pretty self-evident. How much would it take?
I don't know. I'd need to give it some thought.
I think if we could arrive at terms as to sale price and salary requirements, that my client would give you a carte blanche in terms of where you put the operation. In other words, if you prefer to stay in the States, that would be fine. Otherwise, if there's somewhere else you'd care to live, a Caribbean island, perhaps, that could work as well.
You're serious about this, aren't you?
Absolutely.
Okay, Stu said, but there's something you need to know about me. I was raised by my grandfather, and he always insisted that you don't do business with someone unless you can see them face to face and eyeball to eyeball. Dealing with the bank accounts was one thing, but this, a job offer? I wouldn't even consider it without meeting you and the principal in person.
If you want to come in for an interview, I'm pretty sure my client would be willing to fly you down to Panama City first class and put you up in the best hotel possible.
Who is your client?
Obviously, unless we have a deal on the table, that information must remain confidential.
It's not going to happen then, Stu said, pulling back abruptly, after hopefully giving her the impression that he had been about to say yes. When Graciela spoke again, even he was able to detect the audible concern in her voice.
Why not?
Because of something else you don't know about me, he said. I'm afraid of flying, petrified even. If you want me to consider any of this at all seriously, then you'll have to come to me.
Very well, Graciela said. Let me speak to my client. I'll be in touch.
Stu ended the call. Then, spent with effort, he slammed the phone down on the table and turned on the Bluetooth.
Frigg.
Yes, Stuart, how can I help?
I'm going to take a shower and change clothes. I just recorded a telephone call between me and Graciela Miramar. While I'm gone, I want you to listen to the recording and then give me your analysis when I get back.
Sure thing, Stuart, Frigg said. I'll get right on it.
Chapter 52. Filled with revulsion, Graciela put down the phone and shoved the offending computer as far away from her as possible. What she really wanted to do was throw the damn thing out the nearest window. She felt so violated and betrayed that she didn't want to touch it. The simple task of keying in the access codes and activating Stuart's accounts had left her feeling sick to her stomach. How could Odin have done this to her? But he had, and now she needed to fix it. She couldn't afford a moment of delay. She'd have to go to the States and reel Stuart in, something that had to be done in person and in a hurry. She had to get to Stuart, gain his trust, and lay claim to Frigg in time to destroy the AI before Stuart acquired any real understanding of the incredible gold mine that had fallen into his lap. Before he realized that Frigg's keylogger, Trojan, had been deployed against her with potentially devastating results. Making flight reservations, both commercial and private, was second nature to Graciela Miramar. It was something she did on a daily basis for one client or another. Out of habit, she reached for her phone. She touched it and then yanked her hand away as though she'd been burned. It wasn't that she couldn't use her phone to call the airlines. The keylogger was on her computer rather than on her phone. At least she hoped that was the case. But how the hell would she pay the plane fare? If Frigg had been tracking her keystrokes, then she knew all of Graciela's secrets. Her account numbers, passcodes, and balances. Frigg would have access to all of it, both the legitimate accounts and the ones on the dark web. The moment Graciela paid for a reservation, Frigg would know all about it. Frigg was frighteningly smart. That much was obvious. After all, she had outwitted Odin completely, managing to guarantee her own survival by trapping poor, unsuspecting Stuart Ramey, a complete stranger, into assuming ownership of the AI and rebooting her. So it wasn't just that Frigg knew all of Graciela's secrets. She knew Felix's too, along with all of his account numbers, passcodes, and balances. If the AI had been clever enough to bribe Stuart by appropriating Odin's money, what were the chances she'd go straight to El Pescado himself to spill the beans? For the first time in 26 years, Graciela was stuck, as helpless as that little girl whose mother had gone to work and left her alone to make her way in the world. It wasn't quite that bad. She still had her emergency stash, 2 packets of Felix's $100 bills, stowed away in her closet safe. But she couldn't risk paying cash for plane reservations. The moment she tried that, security would be all over her. Looking at her watch, Graciela was astonished to see how much time had elapsed. It was already nearly 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Isabel was coming for her at 5 to take her to the vigil, Arturo's vigil. And that's where Graciela found her answer, in Arturo Salazar, the slimy little bastard himself. All the girls in the office had joked about knowing his passcode, his wife's name plus 4, Natalia 1234. Since it was easy to remember, he never bothered to change it. Every once in a while, when he was out on one of his assignations, someone would duck into his office, turn on his computer, and check out his browsing history. It was always the same thing, porn. Every kind of porn imaginable. Graciela threw on her clothing and a pair of comfortable walking shoes. Then, grabbing her purse, she set out for the office on Via Israel. A tasteful sign, posted on the front door and penned in Isabel's distinctive calligraphy, announced, "Hoy cerrado. Close today." No reason was given. The door itself was locked, but that was no problem. Graciela often came in during off hours and had her own key. The alarm was on, but that wasn't a problem either, because Graciela knew the code. She stepped inside. Without turning on any lights, she made her way back to Arturo's office and sat down at his desk. His computer was old and clunky. It took a long time to boot up, but once it did, the passcode worked like a charm. She found his bill-paying program, and there were the names and numbers of all his credit cards, including his corporate Platinum Amex. Flying private would have been faster and easier, but the price tag for that would most likely blow Arturo's balance through the roof. Graciela knew that Sky Harbor in Phoenix was the closest major airport to Cottonwood. She also knew that the most direct flight, late in the afternoon, was on American with a 2-hour layover in Miami. When she logged on to American's website with Arturo's customary password, she was pleased to discover that he already had an established account with all of his credit card information preloaded into the system. She made a first-class round-trip reservation, departing on Tuesday and returning on Friday. She was coming for Stuart at Frigg. That would give her 2 full days to do what needed to be done, and 2 days would have to be enough. The reservations were made under her own name. She had a cache of phony IDs and passports available, but she might need to use those later on. For right now, traveling under the name of Graciela Miramar worked. The flight would leave Panama City at 5 p.m. the following afternoon and have her in Phoenix at midnight. When it came time to pay, she held her breath and clicked on the proper credit card number. When the system called for the card's expiration date, that wasn't difficult at all. The company Amex cards had all been reissued a few months earlier. The expiration date on Graciela's card was the same as the one on Arturo's. Graciela didn't bother making a room reservation or renting a car. Both of those would have required on-site credit cards. Instead, she placed a call on a burner phone to one of her known contacts. For $500 cash, a car and driver would be waiting for her when she stepped off the plane in Phoenix. For an additional $1,000, the driver would bring along another burner phone and a pair of lethal fentanyl patches. At this point, the idea of gaining custody of the AI with the intention of utilizing her was off the table. Frigg had targeted Graciela and needed to be destroyed. She hoped that Stuart Ramey would agree to hand Frigg over, but if he didn't, then Graciela would do what needed to be done, and that's why she needed the patches. Thanks to the 2 bundles of cartel cash stashed away in her safe, she'd have just under the legal limit of $10,000 along on the trip, enough to handle any number of incidental expenses. By the time Graciela finished making her flight reservations, she was still outside the 24-hour check-in deadline, but she didn't dare hang around the office long enough to make that happen. Having to check in at the airport wouldn't be that big a deal. After erasing her browsing history, she shut down Arturo's computer, turned off his office lights, and locked the office door behind her. She was back home, showered, dressed, made up, and waiting down in the lobby when Isabel arrived at 5 o'clock sharp. As they wended their way through the city on their way to the vigil, Graciela leaned back in her seat, closed her eyes, and said a heartfelt thank you to poor, dead Arturo Salazar. In all these years, making that plane trip possible for her was just by far the nicest thing he had ever done for her. Chapter 53. Halfway through the afternoon, Cammy stopped by Allie's office to voice her complaint.
"I don't like doing busy work," Cammy grumbled.
"What busy work?" Allie asked. Taking a seat rather than answering aloud, Cammy slid a stack of computer printouts across Allie's desk. Shuffling through them, Allie quickly ascertained that these were copies of articles containing press coverage of the attack on Christina Miramar. Included were articles about the subsequent court proceedings along with a complete set of obituaries outlining the untimely deaths of each of the men involved in the crime.
"Why are you doing this?" Allie asked.
"Because Stu asked me to. He's having me research all these guys independently without any assistance from the previous sort Frigg already did, which is incredibly time-consuming. Not only that, I'm getting nowhere fast. I've tried talking to the various cop shops involved, but since I've got no legal basis for requesting autopsy reports or police records, they won't help me. Lawrence Tompkins, the guy from Medford, Oregon, used a gun to blow his brains out. That one's pretty self-explanatory.
The two overdose deaths barely caused a ripple. As for the hit and run in Fresno, Alfred Miller was last seen hitchhiking after leaving a bar on the outskirts of Fresno just after closing time. He never made it home. His body was found floating in an irrigation ditch 2 days later. He had been struck by a car and killed instantly before being dragged off the shoulder of the road and dumped into a canal. The offending vehicle and driver were never found. Then there are the two shooting victims, one in Detroit and the other in Chicago. Both of those cases remain unsolved. Cammy came around to Allie's side of the desk and searched through the printouts before selecting one. "Here we have the obituary for Cameron Randall Purdy, age 26, she said. "Shot to death by an unknown assailant in Chicago, Illinois, on September 24, 1992. He was the first of the six to die, but don't expect anybody to hop to and go sorting through cold case files looking for the shooter. Purdy died 25 years ago. So far this year, Chicago has had more than 600 shootings, and most of those are unsolved as well." "So as far as the cops are concerned, Purdy's death is ancient history," Allie put in. "Right. And nobody's interested in talking about it. They won't give me the time of day." "Have you tried contacting the families?" Allie asked. "These are obituaries with mention of surviving family members." "You want me to talk to these people?" Cammy asked in disbelief. "You want me to talk to the families and bring up all this bad old stuff that's probably best forgotten?" "You might be surprised," Allie told her. "The families of most murder victims count their days by what their lives were like prior to that person's death and what their lives have been like afterward. Yes, these six guys committed a horrible crime and mostly got away with it. And yes, they're all dead now, but before any of that happened, they were somebody's son or brother or friend. And after all these years, their surviving loved ones might be grateful to know that someone is still interested in what happened. That's especially true of the three cases that are still listed as open." "What am I supposed to do?" Cammy asked. "Pretend to be some kind of cold case cop?" "Don't try to pass yourself off as law enforcement," Allie advised. "Tell them whatever you like. Maybe you're a blogger. Maybe tell them you're writing a book on unsolved homicides. In any case, I can see where Stu is going with this. While you're out turning over stones, if you do happen to dig up some new evidence, it won't be tainted by having been conjured up by Frigg."
"Illegally conjured up, you mean?"
"That too."
"All right," Cammy said. "I'll see what I can do. But don't hold your breath."
"By the way," Allie said, "where are you working?"
"The break room," Cammy said. "With that transmitter still up and running in the computer lab, I can't talk about any of this in there."
A still unhappy Cammy returned to her temporary workstation. With a fully operational AI, to do this kind of grunt work, it seemed ridiculous to be reinventing the wheel. But maybe that was one of the reasons work was a four-letter word. An hour and a half later, Cammy found herself speaking by phone to a woman named Darlene Miller at her apartment in an assisted living facility in Fresno, California. Darlene's only son, Alfred Miller, a.k.a. Skip, was the hit-and-run victim who had died August 14, 1993. Only a few words into the conversation, Cammy learned that Allie was right. Darlene Miller wasn't offended that someone was bringing up her son's name. Instead, she was supremely grateful.
"Skip wasn't the best of kids," she admitted. "Troubled, I guess you'd call him, but I loved him anyway. I thought joining the Air Force would help straighten him out, and for a while that seemed to work. Then he got caught up in that awful mess down in Panama. Too much booze, too few brains, if you ask me. He came home in way worse shape than when he left. Couldn't get his act together. Couldn't find a job. I let him stay with me and had lined up some construction work for him, framing houses for a friend of mine. He was supposed to start work the following Monday, so he went out with some friends to celebrate on Saturday night and never came home. Instead of starting a new job on Monday morning,
A farm worker spotted him floating face down in an irrigation canal.
And they never found out who did it? Cammy asked.
I don't think they looked very hard, Darlene replied. I believe the cops examined Skip's history and figured he was expendable.
They did locate the place where it happened, just up the road from where he'd been drinking with his buddies. I always wondered if it really was an accident, or if someone had it in for him, waited around till Skip left the bar alone that night and then ran him down.
So you never believed it was an accident?
I didn't.
Any particular reason?
Women's intuition, maybe? Darlene asked.
Frank, one of Skip's buddies, who was at the bar with him, told me at the funeral that there were some strangers hanging around the bar that night, people they'd never seen before or since. Frank seemed to think one of them might have been keeping a little too close of an eye on Skip. I said he needed to mention that to the cops. He told me he already had, but that it didn't do any good. It's been a long time, but it still hurts, you know. He was my son, and I miss him.
I'm sure you do, Cammy said. I'm very sorry for your loss.
Thank you for saying that, Darlene said, struggling to stifle a sob. Even after all these years, it means so much to hear those words. Parents shouldn't have to bury their children.
Heartened by Darlene's cordial response, Cammy went searching for the family of Richard David Thorne, the drive-by shooting victim from Detroit. To no avail. The obituary mentioned his being survived by his parents, Susan and Robert Thorne. After an hour of diligent searching, Cammy learned that both were deceased. End of that story. Dutifully, Cammy turned her attention back to Cameron Randall Purdy, who had died in Chicago, Illinois, on September 24, 1992. At the time of his death, Cameron's father was listed as deceased. He was survived by his mother Mary and his younger brother James, both of Morton Grove. Rather than attempting to track down another aging or deceased parent, Cammy went after the brother directly and found him still living in Morton Grove with a listed phone number.
"Mr. Purdy?" she asked.
"This better not be one of them solicitation calls," he growled at her. "I'm on the national do-not-call list."
"It's not," she said. "My name is Camille Lee. I'm calling about your brother."
"My brother is dead."
"I'm aware of that. I'm also aware that even though he died in 1992, his death remains unsolved. I was wondering if the Chicago Police Department has ever made any effort to reopen that case."
"When hell freezes over," James said. "They couldn't care less. Cameron got himself in some hot water while he was in the service. When he came home, my folks wouldn't even let him inside the house. He was my big brother, though, and I loved him. He used to take me to White Sox games. Once I got my license, I snuck out to meet him a couple of times. There was a hot dog joint just down the street, and we'd meet up there. The last time I saw him was 2 nights before he died. He was over the moon. He had gotten a job as a mechanic and had a new girlfriend. Tracy was her name. Tracy with an I. Can't remember her last name. Anyway, it felt to me like he was getting his life back on track, and then, just like that, he was gone."
"What happened?"
"Him and Tracy... wait a second. Rhodes was her last name. Tracy Rhodes. They were parked in the street in front of her apartment just off Skokie, making out, when this guy walks up to the car and taps on the driver's window. Cameron rolls it down to see what's up, and the guy hauls off and shoots him at point-blank range. No provocation, no crosswords, nothing. Just kerblammo. Left Tracy covered with blood and brains. I don't think the poor girl ever got over it. And that wasn't the worst part. The cops acted like they thought she had something to do with it. She had this ex-boyfriend, you see, one of those street toughs. And the cops thought this was one of those romantic triangle types of deals. Tracy swore the shooter wasn't her ex, that he'd had nothing to do with it. She even did one of those composite drawing things, but the cops claimed she just made the guy up, invented an imaginary face to keep from fingering the ex.
Were she and her former boyfriend ever arrested and charged?
Never. They both got off for lack of evidence. Even though my parents had disowned Cameron, that didn't keep my mother from blaming Tracy for what happened.
But you didn't?
Nope. I thought the cops made the right call on that. And the fact that I did was the final straw that tore our family apart. My mother's still alive, as far as I know, but we haven't spoken for the past 15 years. And all this time, from the time Cameron died until right this minute, it's burned my butt something fierce to know that whoever did it got away clean. A few years ago, I heard about that TV show called America's Most Wanted. I thought maybe that John Walsh guy could help reopen Cameron's case and get it solved. Didn't happen, of course. But I nosed around enough that I was able to lay hands on a copy of that old composite drawing, the one Tracy did back in the day. Once I did, I could see why the cops thought it was a put-up deal, and phony as a $3 bill. The guy in the drawing doesn't even look human, more like a dead fish.
Cammy heard the words, and her heart skipped a beat. I beg your pardon?
You know how a dying fish looks, sort of gasping, puckery-shaped mouth, no eyebrows, hardly any ears.
Goose flesh spread down Cammy's legs. That composite drawing you mentioned, she said, you wouldn't still happen to have a copy of it, would you?
Sure, I kept it. Why?
Is there a chance you'd be able to take a picture of it and email it to me?
How come?
Because I think I may know who killed your brother. Chapter 54. Stu had spent most of the afternoon communing with Frigg via text, rather than Bluetooth, for fear of being overheard. Texting by phone was a slow, cumbersome process. Finally, in desperation, he paired a spare keyboard with a phone. He didn't think it was possible for Frigg to infect that. There was no sign that Graciella had actually taken the bait. As far as Frigg could ascertain from her credit cards and bank accounts, there had been no transfers or purchases. And after being online almost constantly for the previous 24 hours, all of her accounts had gone dark. Emails voicing questions and concerns about the high noon intrusion were still coming in, and those had to be answered in a timely fashion. But Stu found his ability to concentrate flagging. He had been close to asking Allie if she'd let him take off early and give him a ride back to the village, when a text came in from Cammy, written in bold all caps. Come to the break room now. You have got to see this. Stiff and sore from sleeping either in a chair or on a chaise, Stu levered himself upright and lumbered out of the computer lab.
What? He demanded. What's going on?
Cammy's iPad and cell phone lay side by side on the table. Take a look, she said. Stu leaned over and stared down at the two devices. The iPad held the mugshot image of El Pescado that Stuart had seen before when Frigg had put it up on a screen in the man cave. Cammy must have downloaded it from the internet. When he glanced at the phone's much smaller screen, Stu's first impression was that he was seeing the same thing. When he picked up the phone to study the screen more closely, he realized they weren't the same thing at all. One was a photo. The other was a drawing. El Pescado? He asked wonderingly. Where did you get this? It's a composite drawing done by a woman named Tracy Rhodes, Cameron Randall Purdy's girlfriend, who happened to be in the car with him the night he was shot at point-blank range. An eyewitness? Cammy nodded. When she did the drawing, the cops thought she made it up as a cover for an old boyfriend. Where is she? Stu asked. She was in the Chicago area in 1992. I have no idea where she is now. Stu reached for his Bluetooth.
Frigg.
Good evening, Stuart. How can I help?
I need you to track someone named Tracy Rhodes. That's T-R-A-C-I.
Is that a maiden name or a married name?
I couldn't tell you, and I don't have a middle initial either. All I do know is that she was living in the Chicago area in 1992.
Of course, Stuart, Frigg said. Let me see what I can do.
How do we explain this if Frigg does find her? Cammy asked.
We'll cross that bridge when we come to it, Stu told her. It took all of 11 minutes for Frigg to locate Tracy Rhodes Cantrell, now a married mother of three, living on a 10-acre parcel just outside the city limits of Boise, Idaho. According to the report Frigg provided, Tracy had been married to Steve Cantrell for 17 years. Her husband was self-employed, owning and operating a small contracting business, while Tracy taught second grade. Frigg, ever efficient, provided a full catalog of addresses and phone numbers.
So, what do we do now? Stuart asked. Do we call her, or do we hand this over to the cops?
Let's see, Cammy said. I believe you wanted me to be on the up with this? We learned about the Duarte cartel because of the intrusion and have been researching same, with all my browsing history still fully intact, just as you requested. So I'm clean. I'll have to figure out a way to have located her phone number on my own, but otherwise I'm good. I should be able to call her and get away with it.
That whole experience must have been a nightmare for her. Should we even bring it up?
25 years ago, Tracy had a brand new boyfriend who was murdered in front of her eyes. At the time, the cops thought she was involved, if not responsible. They probably still do. All the way along, the only person who believed her story was Cameron's brother, James. I think finding out that there are other people who believe her will be a blessing to her rather than a curse.
All right, then, Stu said. We'll call her, but on one condition.
What's that?
You're the one who has to talk to her. I've done my one phone call for the day.
A minute later, Cammy dialed the phone Frigg had listed as Tracy's home number. A man answered.
Cantrell residence.
May I speak to Tracy? Cammy asked.
She's busy cooking. Can I tell her who's calling and what this is about?
It's about a homicide that took place near Morton Grove, Illinois in 1992.
Hey, hon, Steve Cantrell said. You might want to take this in the bedroom. I'll finish getting dinner on the table.
A few seconds later, a woman's voice came on the phone.
Who's calling? She asked warily.
Why couldn't I take this call downstairs? My name is Camille Lee, and I work for a company called High Noon Enterprises, Cammy told her. I've been investigating a break-in that occurred at our corporate headquarters in Cottonwood, Arizona last week. In the process, I've come across the story of a woman named Christina Miramar, who was attacked in Panama City, Panama, back in 1989.
Oh, God, not that again. I know all about it. I dated one of the guys who was part of that whole mess.
Cameron told me about it when we first met. He said he was so drunk at the time he didn't even remember. But he was part of it, and he took his medicine along with everybody else. I think he thought I'd break up with him as soon as he told me, but I'd done some stupid stuff, too.
And then he was killed.
Right in front of you.
Yes, she breathed.
And the cops thought you did it.
That, too.
Do you have a cell phone with you right now? Cammy asked.
It's in my pocket. Why?
If you wouldn't mind sending me the number, I'd like to send you a text.
Are you sure this isn't some kind of a scam? Are you trying to get my number so you can put it out on the internet?
I can assure you this isn't a scam, Cammy said. I want to send you a mugshot of the guy I think murdered Cameron Purdy, and at least four of those other six guys from the Christina Miramar case. The entire transaction took less than a minute. When the image came through, Cammy heard Tracy gasp.
Oh, my God, it's him. The one who did it. Where is he? Is he still alive? How did you find him?
Cammy heard a man's voice in the background.
Okay, the kids are eating. What's going on?
After that, for the better part of 2 minutes, all Cammy and Stuart were able to hear over both phones was the sound of Tracy Rhodes Cantrell's racking sobs. Finally, her husband's voice came on the landline.
"I'm hanging up now," he said. "We'll have to call you back."
Chapter 55. For obvious reasons, the celebration that followed was confined to the break room, well away from that one remaining transmitter.
"Tracy called us back after she pulled herself together," Cammy explained to Allie and Bea. "She wanted to know what she should do. I told her that was up to her. I suggested to her that going to the cops would probably bring all of that old business back to light. If she didn't want to go there, it was perfectly understandable. I mean, she's a whole other person now. She has kids of her own. She teaches school. I warned her that going to the cops might throw all that into uproar. I gave her James Purdy's number in case she wanted to be in touch with him. The last thing Tracy said to me was that she and her husband would talk it over and decide what to do.
The thing is, I'm not sure her going to the cops would do any good," Stu said. "If an Illinois DA decided to press charges, it would be a circumstantial case at best based on eyewitness testimony only and with no physical evidence. Besides, El Pescado is holed up in Sinaloa. If the U.S. isn't trying to extradite him over something as recent and horrific as that series of firebombings, the chances of his ever being brought to trial on a 25-year-old case are slim to non-existent." That dose of reality sucked the jubilation out of the room.
"Trial or not," Allie said, "what you two did today was huge. You validated what that poor woman has been saying for a quarter of a century. She's been walking under a cloud of suspicion for all this time, and you gave her a way to possibly fix that."
"What about the other families?" Cammy asked. "Should I get back to them with that composite drawing?"
"I think so," Allie said. "Cameron Purdy's family deserved some answers, and so do the others. We may not be able to give them convictions, but having answers and some idea of who was responsible may help."
"I'll work on that tomorrow, then," Cammy promised. "But for right now, I'm done."
And so was everyone else. That long, exhausting weekend from Friday through Monday had drained them all. Like Cammy, Stuart, too, was at the end of his endurance.
"Are you going to stay here?" Allie asked him as they were getting ready to close down for the day. "Or would you like a ride back to the village?"
"Village," Stu answered. "I'd like to do some work with Frigg on the screens instead of the iPhone. But first, let me grab a few things, including some sweaters and jackets. I damn near froze to death last night, and maybe we can pick up a pizza on the way."
An hour later, layered in two sweaters and with a piece of pepperoni pizza in hand, Stuart Ramey settled into a chair in front of Control Central, donned his headset, and summoned Frigg.
"Good evening, Stuart. Is there something you need?"
"Yes. What's going on with our friend Graciela today?"
"Is Graciela our friend? I thought she was on the other team, the bad guy team."
Stu shook his head. Frigg was smart, but not subtle.
"I was being sarcastic."
"Sarcastic," Frigg repeated. "Having to do with sarcasm. A sharp, often satirical or ironic utterance meant to be hurtful. So when you said the word friend, you did not mean friend?"
"Friend or foe? Does it really matter?" an exasperated Stu replied. "Just answer the question, please."
"Ms. Miramar has gone completely dark," Frigg reported. "She was logged into an audio storage account on the dark web earlier today. Once she logged out of that, there has been no additional usage on either one of her computers or on her cell phone."
That pretty much confirmed what Stu had suspected. Graciela knew about Frigg for sure now, and she suspected she'd been hacked, so of course she'd gone dark.
"What about financial transactions?"
Any credit card dealings with airlines or private jet providers?
Not that I can see.
That was disappointing. There was no way to tell for sure if Graciela had taken the bait.